nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
The goal in this lecture, there's going to be a bunch. We'd like to be able to calculate scattering rates. So we're going to go through the mathematics of how you actually do these calculations. And then we will be over the hump and we'll talk about results. So just by way of quick review, we've got this prescription based on Fermi's golden rule. Main thing is we need to compute this matrix element squared. And there's an assumption here that there's weak scattering. Right. We're going to assume our incident and exiting waves are plane waves. If we get a chance, maybe next week we'll talk a little more about what those block functions do, see how that works out. So in general, you need to multiply this matrix element by an overlap integral between the initial and final block function, and that can numerically affect the results. And we talked about the electron-phonon coupling. So we went through the physics of deformation potentials and polar optical interactions. And we saw that we can always, at the end, write the electron-phonon coupling as some coupling constant, which can be wave vector dependent, times the lattice displacement. So that's the scattering potential that we'll put into the matrix element. And then we need to look at the amplitude of this phonon wave vector, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that and fix a factor of two error that I had before. We've got to be careful about how we do that, but the magnitude squared of the lattice displacement is related to the energy. It's also related to the number of phonons or the phonon occupation number. So we'll talk about that a little bit more and see where that comes from. You know, there's been some questions about, you know, what's an elastic scattering mechanism? What's an inelastic one? If it's a static potential, it's always elastic. Ionized impurity scattering, you know, some kind of defect scattering, neutral impurity scattering, surface roughness scattering, whatever. If it's time varying, then there's going to be some energy exchange. But sometimes the energy exchange is small enough that we consider it almost elastic and we ignore it. Acoustic phonon scattering frequently falls into that category, but not always. We have these phonon dispersions, and we understood a little bit about those. So it's just like electrons in periodic material have a dispersion that's periodic, and we talk about Brillouin zones. Lattice vibrations in a periodic material display the same kind of periodicity, and we compute their dispersion. Instead of E versus K, it's omega versus beta, but it's really the same thing. And we're going to show in this lecture that we're most interested in the phonons near wave vector zero and at the edge of the Brillouin zone. And we discussed last time that it's mostly the longitudinal oscillations that couple to the electrons. So we're going to use this simplified description of the dispersion when we do the analytical calculations. People who do it numerically, you know, sometimes use the full dispersions. So just by way of recalling, we went through and derived the coupling constants for four different types of scattering mechanisms: acoustic deformation potential scattering, optical deformation potential scattering, piezoelectric scattering, which is acoustic phonons in polar materials, and then polar optical phonon scattering, which is optical phonons in polar materials. And there are lots of other scattering mechanisms that we're not going to have time to talk about, but we'll get the basic idea of how this all works. Okay, so the first question today is, you know, which phonons take place in these electron phonon scattering events? You know, we have a whole Brillouin zone, and we want to try to determine which phonons we have to worry about. I just argued it's going to be the ones near K equals zero for intra-valley scattering. But it's kind of interesting to see how that all works. So let's see if we can do that. We have a simplified dispersion that looks something like this on the left. And the geometry of the event, remember, An electron comes in with some wave vector p, scatters off at some angle alpha, and h bar beta is the change in momentum that connects the initial and final state. The delta function we have in Fermi's golden rule tells us that if we wait long enough after the scattering event, then energy is conserved. So the final energy is the initial energy plus or minus h bar omega, depending on whether we absorbed or emitted a lattice vibration. And the final momentum is plus or initial momentum plus or minus h bar beta. That's the momentum that comes from the lattice vibration. That's the wave vector of the lattice vibration. So we have these energy and momentum conservation equations. I'm assuming a parabolic band now. I think in the homework I suggested for this lecture, I ask you to work out everything I'm about to do for graphene. See how it works out for graphene. But this is energy and momentum conservation. And remember, it just came from evaluating Fermi's golden rule. We didn't assume it up front. We evaluated Fermi's golden rule. We found that energy was conserved if we waited long enough after the scattering event. And when we do the matrix element, we found that the only terms that survive are terms in which p prime is equal to p plus or minus h bar beta, and we interpret that as momentum conservation. That just came out of doing the Fermi's golden rule calculation. Okay, so if I take the momentum conservation and dot it with itself, then I get magnitude of p prime squared is equal to magnitude of p squared plus or minus blah, blah, the rest of the equation. Now, if I divide by 2m and then move the p squared over 2m to the left-hand side, then the energy conservation equation will say that that should be plus or minus h bar omega. So I'm beginning with the equation that satisfies the momentum conservation. Now I'm bringing in energy conservation, and I get an equation that has to be satisfied when both energy and momentum are conserved. Okay. Now, I can pick my z-axis to be anywhere that it's convenient. So let me pick the z-axis to be along the incident wave vector beta. Then my angle theta here I'm going to define as its polar angle. It's going to be the angle between beta and the incident momentum. So when I take p dot beta, it's magnitude of p times magnitude of beta times cosine theta. Okay. And the result then of doing that, and then once I do that, and then I solve for, I solve the resulting equation for beta, I'm going to get an equation that looks like this. I haven't quite solved for beta because I've got beta on both sides here now. But this is the equation we're going to work with. This is an equation that tells me whenever energy and momentum is simultaneously satisfied, then this equation is satisfied, and I'll be able to figure out what the maximum beta is, what happens at different scattering angles, and things like that. Remember, the plus, the sign, I should write this a little bit differently. The sign on the top always refers to absorption. The sign on the bottom always refers to emission. So if I'm talking about absorption, it's minus cosine theta plus omega over beta alpha. Top is absorption, bottom is emission. Right? And it just, you know, when I began with it was plus or minus meant absorption, emission, and when I went through and did the math, there were some minus signs, so things flipped around. Okay, so what we want to find is, first of all, notice that I'm assuming intra-valley scattering here. Because everything is happening within one valley. I have the same effective mass. I'm just making a small wave vector change within one valley. I'm not adding any reciprocal lattice vector and going to another valley at the other end of the Brillouin zone. So everything that I'm assuming here refers to scattering within a valley. And what we want to find is what's the maximum magnitude of beta. So I can find whether I'm near the origin of the Brillouin zone, or if I'm out in the end, or if I have to worry about this detailed shape of the dispersion. Okay, so let's just look at absorption and see if we can figure out what the maximum beta is. So I'll just take the top sign And my equation that satisfies energy and momentum conservation is this one here on the right. If I ask what is the largest value that h bar beta can have, you know, then I'd put theta equal pi. And minus cosine theta would be plus 1. So the biggest magnitude of phonon wave vector that would be involved in a scattering event that can satisfy energy and momentum conservation would be given by this equation. Okay. And if I look at this pictorially, what's happening? I'm coming in with a wave vector P. I'm going to actually scatter back 180 degrees to a wave vector P prime, and H bar beta is the wave vector. If I add P plus H bar beta, it'll give me my P prime. So the angle is 180 degrees. So this is what the scattering event looks like, and what we're interested in is how big is this vector? What's its magnitude? Okay. Let's see. I guess we'll get that. We'll come back and take a look at that later, because the next step to answer that question, I need to know something about omega over beta. That tells me something about the dispersion characteristics. So I'm going to get different answers depending on whether I'm talking about optical phonons or acoustic phonons. Right now, I've made no specification as to whether these are acoustic phonons or optical phonons. All right, let's do the same thing with emission. You just take the bottom sign, and we get an expression for the magnitude of H bar beta when there's a phonon that's emitted. Here, if I want to find the biggest magnitude that occurs, it'll be when cosine theta is plus 1. That means theta is equal to 0. So what that means, again, is that H bar beta is going to point in the opposite direction. So I'm going to have P prime is equal to P minus H bar beta, or it's easier to see that P is equal to P prime plus H bar beta. H bar beta is just flip sign, but the biggest value continues to occur in this backscattering event, even though it's with emission. We just have a wave vector with a beta with a different sign. And I have a 1 minus omega over beta times V. All right, so now let's get specific. Let's put acoustic phonons in. We have an expression for the biggest value of beta. We did it for absorption and emission, and we got an expression that looked like this. Now, let me assume that I'm near beta equals 0. And then when we get done later, we can double check and see that it's all consistent and we are indeed there. Because if I'm near beta equals 0, then omega divided by beta is just the sound velocity. That makes everything nice and simple. So it means my maximum phonon wave vector is 2 times the incident momentum times 1 plus or minus the sound velocity divided by the velocity of electrons. Okay. Sound velocity is something like 5 times 10 to the 5th centimeters per second in most semiconductors. You know, typical electron velocity for an average electron that's undergoing one of these scattering events, the average velocity is around the thermal velocity, about 10 to the 7th. So this is 1 plus or minus less than a tenth. Okay. So H bar beta is very nearly 2p. All right. And that is what you would expect for an elastic collision. You go in with momentum p. It's like I throw a ball at that wall. You go in with a momentum p. It bounces back elastically and comes back with a momentum p in the opposite direction. And that's what happens here. You go in with P, backscatter, magnitude of P prime is about the same, and magnitude of H bar beta is just twice the magnitude of the incident momentum.
So yes. Acoustic is nearly elastic?
Yes, that's what we're...
So what's the physical...
Near room temperature, right? Because if I go down to liquid nitrogen temperature, the thermal velocity is going to be a lot smaller. And that means that this ratio here will be much bigger. right? The ratio of the sound velocity to the thermal electron velocity will be much bigger. So at liquid nitrogen temperature, it would not be such a good approximation to consider it elastic. Yeah. So the point is, so it's very commonly people will make this assumption, near room temperature acoustic phonon scattering is elastic. You know, it's worth realizing that this assumption is commonly made. If you're running somebody else's program and you decide, well, I'd like to see what happens at liquid nitrogen temperature, you have to be careful, because it's quite likely that they might have assumed that the acoustic phonons are elastic. If you lower the temperature, that won't be a great assumption. And you'll have to know how they calculated the scattering rates and whether they made that assumption or not. There's kind of something else that's kind of interesting, and it's kind of analogous to this Cherenkov radiation of photons. If we're talking about emitting an acoustical phonon, the magnitude, so the average electron has a velocity of 10 to the 7th, but there's a distribution. You know, they have very low velocities and very high velocities. If I ask whether an electron can emit an optical phonon, remember, there's a whole spectrum of omegas. It goes from zero when it goes linearly up. So you'd think that even a slow-moving electron could emit a small-energy optical acoustic phonon. But no, it can't. If you look at this, if you look at emission, it's the bottom sign. So it's 1 minus sound velocity over velocity of an electron. The magnitude of the wave vector, magnitude of any vector, has to be bigger than 1. So I won't get a magnitude bigger than 1 unless the electron has a velocity that's bigger than the sound velocity. So an electron can't emit an acoustic phonon unless it's traveling faster than the sound velocity. And that comes out of energy and momentum conservation. It can't conserve energy and momentum at the same time unless that's true. Okay. So if you look at this, the fact that h-bar beta max is about 2 pi tells us immediately that this looks like an elastic process, because that's exactly what we would expect for an elastic process. So if we're interested, say, in computing, what we're interested in is what fraction of the Brillouin zone is that beta max. So we're interested in dividing that beta max by something like pi over a, the boundary of the Brillouin zone. And if you run through some typical numbers, if you take an average momentum for a thermal average electron, you find that it's something like 1/4 of the Brillouin zone. So we're down here in the region where this dispersion is very nearly linear. That was an assumption we made to begin with, so we were safe to make that assumption. Everything is self-consistent. So when we talk about acoustic phonon scattering that's intra-valley, we're talking about acoustic phonons in this part of the dispersion. And you can also figure out what the maximum energy change is. It's h bar times omega, the maximum omega. The maximum omega is linearly related to the maximum beta through the dispersion. So you plug in numbers and it's something like 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, 1 millielectron volt. Average electron at room temperature has something like 26 millielectron volts. All right. So on average, it's probably okay to assume that it's elastic. Okay, we could do the same argument with the optical phonons. We have the same expression that conserves energy and momentum. Okay, we just have a different relation between omega and beta because they have a different dispersion characteristic. Let's see. So optical phonons are pretty flat. They have a constant omega independent of beta to first order. So when I plug that into this equation, I have omega naught, the optical phonon energy, divided by beta. Now in order to find beta max, I have to solve a quadratic equation to find out what beta max is. If I solve for beta, first of all, I'll just solve a quadratic equation, and then I can find out what beta max is. And so first of all, if you look at this, if I take the top sign for absorption, I'll always get a positive value for h-bar beta max. So there's never any problem in absorbing an optical phonon. If I try to emit an optical phonon, if my incident electron has an energy that's less than the optical phonon energy, then I'm going to get the square root of a negative number, and I'll have an imaginary magnitude of the phonon wave vector, which doesn't make any sense. So it sort of seems physical that if I'm going to emit an optical phonon, the electron has to have more energy than an optical phonon. It's going to lose h bar omega naught, so it has to have at least h bar omega naught of energy before it can excite one of those. H bar omega naught, I think in gallium arsenide, it's about 32 millielectron volts or something like that. It's bigger than KT. So if you go to high temperatures, you might be able to assume that optical phonon scattering is elastic, but near room temperature or below, you wouldn't be able to assume that. Okay. All right. Questions before we... Okay, so the phonons we're going to be interested in for intra-valley scattering are near the zone boundary, and we were able to get some insight into, you know, there are going to be these thresholds. You can't emit an optical phonon unless the electron has enough energy to do so, so there'll be a sharp turn-on of that process. And even for acoustic phonons, the electrons have to travel faster than the sound velocity to emit one. Okay, so now it's time we can roll up our sleeves and actually set up the calculation, and then in the example we'll do the calculation. And then I don't think I'll do any, I may assign one for a homework just so that you see how to do it, but you'll know how the calculations proceed then when you have to do it. So here's our results. We have Fermi's golden rule, we have a matrix element, we have a scattering potential, and we figured out what the K's are for the common phonon scattering mechanisms. And we have a lattice vibration, and I'm just showing the spatial dependence here because the time dependence we've already accounted for gave us this delta function of energy. Okay, so we evaluate the matrix element. We just plug the scattering potential inside. When we work out this matrix element, if I collect up all the exponentials, so P prime is the final wave function, wave vector. P is the initial. And then beta, oops, there should be an H bar beta there. Send me an email so I don't forget. We just collect up all the exponentials. Now, I integrate this over a sizable volume. You know, this thing is going to oscillate. Everything's going to cancel out. There's only one term that's going to survive. When P prime is equal to P plus or minus H bar beta, momentum conservation, then this exponential is 1, and I integrate that over the volume, I get omega, I had a 1 over omega out front, and I get a 1 in that case. I just get a K beta. So our result is just K beta times the amplitude of the lattice vibration times a Kronecker delta that just expresses momentum conservation, just like we did that example early on when we had an oscillating potential. And what's going to matter for the transition rate is the magnitude squared of this. So we're really going to need the magnitude squared of the coupling constant and of the amplitude, and then we have the phonon wave vector. All right, so here's where we stand. Fermi's golden rule now looks like this. We have a delta function that expresses energy conservation. We have a Kronecker delta, which expresses momentum conservation. And we have a K beta squared that we have already figured out. We know what that is. I have to go back and revisit this, the amplitude squared of the lattice vibration, and fix a factor of 2 problem I had before. So when we actually calculate this, we're going to have 2 delta functions to worry about. So let's see. So I guess let's do that first. You know, we're going to integrate this over final states. And how do we integrate something that's got a Kronecker delta times a regular delta function? Well, remember, what these are doing is just, this is just telling me that energy and momentum has to be conserved at the same time. So the calculation is really very much the same as the one we just went through. You know, we have momentum conservation, we have energy conservation. When I went through the calculation before, we solved for beta, and then we asked questions about what's the maximum magnitude of beta that could result if we satisfy energy and momentum conservation. Here we'll just do the calculation a little bit differently. I'll satisfy momentum conservation, and that gives me a relation between P prime and P prime squared. And then if I subtract P squared and divide by 2m, then I recognize over here E prime minus E on the left-hand side, that's what I have in the argument of the delta function. So if I look at that argument of the delta function, E prime minus E minus or plus H bar omega, which is the argument of my delta function, which was there to conserve energy, if I now use these momentum conservation arguments to derive the same thing and insert that in the argument, then the argument on my delta function, I can write this way, just the same kind of math we did before. You know, do it on your own after class. But the net result of this is I'm going to take a delta function of this quantity here that you see, h bar v beta times the thing in the brackets. If I take a delta function of a times x, it's 1 over a times a delta function of x. So I can replace these Kronecker delta times a delta function in energy by one delta function that simultaneously satisfies energy and momentum conservation. And if I do that, then when I compute an integral, I know how to integrate a delta function. And we've satisfied both energy and momentum conservation, so we've done what we have to do. Okay. So our transition right now looks like the result in the top blue square. And now we have to work on magnitude of A beta squared, because that's a classical concept. We have to get that out of the expression. Then we have everything right, and we can work out the calculation. Okay, so I've been writing this potential as magnitude times e to the plus or minus I beta dot r minus omega t. There are two separate terms there, because when we treat this quantum mechanical scattering process, one is going to lead to an absorption term, and one is going to lead to an emission term. And there are some interference terms between the two, which if you wait long enough, they cancel out. So we get two separate contributions. But now if I want to think about this lattice vibration, you know, what this quantity is really 2 magnitude of the vibration cosine omega t plus some phase factor that had to do with the phase factor of A beta. I dropped a factor of 2 last time when I did this. So we got to be careful about that. And remember that omega is something like square root of spring constant divided by mass. You know. Okay. So we can go ahead and do the argument we did before. We can compute the kinetic energy. It's just 1/2 m velocity squared. So I can just differentiate this twice. It brings down an omega squared. We can produce the kinetic energy. The kinetic energy of a spring is 1/2 k displacement squared, 1/2 kx squared. Here x is u. So I can do the same thing. It's 1/2 k, and then I have something proportional to cosine squared. But I can replace this k by omega squared over m. I replace k by omega squared times m. And when I do it that way, I see that my potential energy is just like my kinetic energy, except that one goes as sine squared, one goes as cosine squared. So one oscillates, one has a maximum, the other is zero, other one has a maximum, the first one is zero. If we add the two together, total energy, kinetic plus potential, we get sine squared plus cosine squared, which is always one. So the sum of the kinetic and the potential is always one. And it's just 2 m omega squared times magnitude A beta squared. Okay, so we have the total energy classically. It's proportional to the amplitude squared of the lattice vibration. But quantum mechanically, we know that it's proportional, it's quantized in units of h bar omega. And it's n omega is going to be some integer number of quanta of lattice vibrations. So if it's a harmonic oscillator, it's got to be quantized that way. So now we have to put that in, and we could do that. We could just solve this equation for the quantum mechanically correct energy, And we could then express magnitude of A beta squared in terms of that. And we would almost have the right answer. But it's not quite right. On average, it's right. But it's not quite right, because it's something a little more subtle. And this is what we talked about earlier. We talked about, when we first talked about scattering, before we did any scattering rate calculations, we talked about this problem that if we're going to satisfy detailed balance, then whatever S of P, P prime, whatever they work out to be after we calculate them, they have to have this probability that the transition up in energy is exponentially smaller than the transition down. Otherwise, we won't satisfy detailed balance. All right, so that has to occur. Now, if we're talking about phonon scattering, where that comes in, we saw, was because we expect you're not going to absorb a phonon unless there's some there. So it's going to be proportional to the occupation number for the phonons, n omega, like the Fermi function. But we saw that the only way that we can satisfy this ratio and make sure that detailed balance works is to say that the emission probability is proportional to the number that are there plus one. So the first part is what you'd call stimulated emission. So you're stimulating the emission of phonons because there's a number that are already there. And then this plus one is spontaneous emission. Even if you're at low temperatures and there are no phonons, if you have an energy that's higher than the phonon energy, you can excite a phonon. And if we assume that absorption is proportional to n omega and emission is proportional to n omega plus one, then you can show that the ratio of these two, if you use the Bose-Einstein factor, the ratio will always come out to be what we need it to be to satisfy detailed balance. Okay. So if we're talking about an absorption, then we should replace magnitude of A beta squared by something proportional to N, the phonon number. And if we're talking about emission, we should replace it by something proportional to N plus 1. Okay. So our final answer is this. The transition rate is 2 pi over h bar, magnitude squared of a coupling constant, times a bunch of constants that came in, n omega plus 1 half minus or plus 1 half. You take the top sign for absorption, the bottom sign for emission. So this gives me n for absorption and n plus 1 for emission. And then a delta function that simultaneously satisfies energy and momentum conservation. Okay. So this is where we stand. You know, this is how far we've gotten. Remember, you go through this carefully on your own. Remember I said there's going to be a bunch of math today. We'll get through this and then we'll know how to do the calculations. And I'll assign a problem for you to work out so that you can make sure that you can do these kind of calculations. So let's use this for something. Let's calculate the scattering rate. Okay. So if we're going to calculate a scattering rate, we're going to do a sum over final states. You know, only the states that have the spin parallel to the incoming one, because none of these phonon scattering processes flip the spin. Now, if I'm summing over P prime, I could just as well sum over beta, because there is a one-to-one relation between P prime and beta. So given an incident momentum, I could either sum over the final states P prime, or I could sum over beta, because I'm essentially doing the same thing. There's a one-to-one relation between them. Turns out, not always. It's sort of every time you reach a calculation, you have to ask yourself, what is it most convenient to sum over? So a lot of the times it's most convenient to sum over beta. Sometimes when you work it out, like I think when you put in non-parabolic bands and you try to work it out, it turns out to be hard to do it in this way, and it's easier to do it over P prime. But for the calculations that we're doing, we're going to sum over beta. So we just take this sum, we convert it to an integral. There's an azimuthal angle. There is a magnitude of beta. And then there is a sine theta d theta from 0 to pi, which I can write as d cosine theta from minus 1 to plus 1. So we're going to get an integral like this that we have to work out. Okay, so we know what S of p and beta are. That's what we had before. It's had this complicated delta function in it, had the n or n plus 1, depending on absorption for emission. So this is the integral that we have to do. And it looks a little bit formidable. Okay. But it's not so bad. So look at that delta function. If I integrate a delta function, then I just get one as long as the, you know, the, where the delta function peaks is between the limits of integration. So if I, all I'm going to get is one. If I'm within those limits, I'm going to get zero otherwise. So that's the only result that that delta function is going to have, is to give me a one or a zero. Okay. So the integration of the delta function, you know, theta can only go from, what does theta go? Cosine theta goes from minus one to plus one. So in order to make the argument of the delta function go to zero, if beta is too big or too small, it can't happen because cosine theta is restricted. So what that delta function is going to do is it's just going to restrict everything to beta min and beta max. It's just going to restrict me to the wave vectors that simultaneously satisfy energy and momentum conservation. If I have a beta that's in that range, it just gives me a one. So the only result of that complicated-looking delta function is that when I, you know, it just gives me a one as long as I restrict my integration of beta to those betas that satisfy energy and momentum conservation. So now I've got a simpler expression to satisfy, and C beta is just all of those constants we had before times magnitude of K beta squared, or K beta was the electron-phonon coupling that we derived. So we know those for each phonon scattering mechanism. So this is a general expression for any one of those four phonon scattering processes. I could just plug in numbers and work it out, and I could get the answer. Okay, what about momentum relaxation rate? Here I think I'll go through it really quickly, and you can go through it more carefully here later. We just do the same kind of calculation, but we weight it by the fractional change in momentum. Okay, so here I have to do a little bit of algebra, and I find my fractional change in momentum is related to h bar beta cosine theta, because I want to express everything in terms of beta. So I can write the momentum relaxation rate as S of p to beta times this quantity here, h bar beta cosine theta over p. That's just a fractional change in momentum re-expressed in terms of beta. Okay. All right. So now I have another integral to do. It's a little more complicated because I picked up this extra term related to the fractional change in momentum. So the integration is just a little bit different. So when I do that integration, that looks like integrating some function of x times a delta function. And as long as the delta function peaks within the limits of the integration, that's just going to give me that function inside the integral evaluated at x naught here. And if I just make the mapping, x in my case, in this case, is cosine theta. The function is h bar beta cosine theta over p with a minus or plus. And x naught is the argument here, and it's just minus h bar beta over 2 pi plus or minus omega over b beta. All right. Plug that all in, and we get an expression. And if I integrate that expression, I know this c beta for all four scattering processes. We can get the scattering rate. Okay. Push on. We do one example to show you how it works, and then you know how to do these calculations. All right, let's do acoustic phonon scattering, see how it all works. So here's our general expression. Here's our beta. You go back and look at our notes or look in the book. You can see C beta is given by a simple expression that depends on the magnitude squared of the deformation potential. We know what the phonon occupation number is. It's this Bose-Einstein factor. Now, we found that the typical phonons, our energy momentum conservation arguments told us that the typical phonons that are involved in these scattering processes have small energy. We say 1 millielectron volt. Compared to KT, that's small. So I can expand e to the h bar omega over KT as e to the x for small x, 1 plus x. Do that expansion, And this occupation factor becomes KT over H bar omega F. Sort of easy to remember. KT is the thermal energy. H bar omega S is how much energy that the phonon carries. So you divide the total thermal energy by the energy of a phonon. That gives you the number of acoustic phonons. And it's big because H bar omega S is much smaller than KT. So N and N plus 1, absorption and emission, are about the same thing. We really don't have to distinguish between absorption and emission. We'll just calculate the scattering rate for one and multiply by two. Right? Because you add one to a large number, it doesn't change anything. People call this equipartition when they make this approximation. Then you're okay. That's so when people say that they've calculated the acoustic phonon scattering rate, you know, in the elastic assumption, assuming equipartition. This is, you know, they're meaning all of this. Okay, so now we can plug this in. We have a simple expression for the phonon number. So the absorption rate is going to be equal to the emission rate. We have an integral to calculate. The integral is relatively easy to do. It's beta squared d beta. And I'm going to write, let's see. I had an omega s down here. I'm going to write beta squared d beta as beta over omega times beta d beta. Beta over omega, my dispersion curve says that, for acoustic phonons, says that omega is sound velocity times beta. So beta over omega is 1 over sound velocity. So that's a constant. So I can pull that outside the integral. And then I have 1 over sound velocity squared. But sound velocity is square root of elastic constant divided by density. And it's like square root of spring constant divided by mass. So when I do that, I pick up a elastic constant out front. I'm integrating beta d beta over the range of betas that satisfy energy and momentum conservation. So I just get beta max squared over 2 minus beta min squared over 2. And now, since we've assumed elastic scattering all through this calculation, I can go back and we can look at what the minimum beta is. Energy and momentum conservation will give that to be 0. The maximum beta will be 2 times the incident momentum. And that means that we can just plug 2p in for beta max, and we can plug 0 in for beta min. We can evaluate the expression. We'll get the same expression for absorption that we get for emission. And typically when people give you the acoustic phonon scattering rate, they just added the two, since the two are equal. So final result of putting that all together is that we get 2 pi over h bar times a bunch of constants that depend on the electron phonon coupling, the temperature to the first power, the elastic constant of the material, and then proportional to the density of states divided by 2. Divided by 2 because only it can only scatter into the spin up or spin down state depending on whether it had spin up or spin down. And it's isotropic, so if I evaluated that much more complicated integral to try to find out what the momentum scattering rate was, I would get the same answer. So the scattering rate versus energy looks like this. For a simple parabolic semiconductor, it's just going to go as a square root of energy. All right. Now I derived that early on for a vibration like a lattice vibration, and I said just assume that there is some phonon that will satisfy momentum conservation. I only did it with energy conservation. Then it's really easy to satisfy. But here we've done it explicitly. We've satisfied momentum and energy conservation at the same time. All right. Here's a good exercise. Repeat this calculation assuming that acoustic phonons don't make the elastic assumption. If you're going to do this calculation at low temperatures like liquid nitrogen, that's not a very good assumption. And you can repeat the calculation and it will work out without very much effort. You'll just have to start at the beginning with the general expression, but don't assume elastic anywhere. And it'll all work out. Okay, now we could do optical deformation potential scattering. And here I'm just going to give you the result. The result is going to be I can't make any equipartition assumptions, so I just have to evaluate the number of optical phonons from the Bose-Einstein factor And n plus 1 will be a lot bigger than n, typically. So the absorption rate will not equal the emission rate. And we'll get these characteristic features, which when we start looking at the general features of scattering semiconductors, we'll see things like this. We can always absorb, and the absorption is going to go proportional to n, but the e to the h bar omega over kt, h bar omega is comparable to kt, so that number is going to be relatively small. And then our energy conservation told us that we can't emit an optical phonon unless we have higher energy, so there will be no optical phonon emission until the incident electron has an energy bigger than h bar omega naught. Then you can emit and scatter by that process, and that process is bigger because it goes as n plus 1, not as n. Yes?
So I wanted to ask about this inequality, the energy inequality that the electron has to satisfy in respect to the optical phonon for emission process to happen. Is it a hard one, or is it possible the electron to be slightly lower in energy and this event to happen? Is it something like equivalent to the tunneling
processes
across
potential. Yeah, I'm not sure if you looked. How hard is it? You know, probably the most serious assumption that we're making is that the scattering is infrequent, so that this delta function in energy exists. If you have a lot of scattering, then you don't get a delta function. You get energy conservation is smeared out. And that's probably the condition under which you might start seeing some phonon scattering happening, you know, before. There's enough uncertainty in the initial and final energies that you could do that. All right. So let's see, a couple of final points. Let's see, I think the question I wanted to ask here is, how do you determine when the scattering process is isotropic? If you look here, so, for example, you look here, it's not obvious looking at it, you know, is this an isotropic process or not? Because I see betas all over the place. I see a beta here. I see a beta inside the expression for C beta. Beta, small beta, if you prefer small betas, that you're preferring small angle scattering. So it's not obvious in looking at that this is going to be an isotropic scattering process. Because we've done some manipulating and we've re-expressed things in the integrals in terms of beta, and that's brought in some things that cancel out in the end. The best way to do that is to go back to the matrix element itself, because the matrix element itself tells you the strength of the coupling between one P and another P. And if there's an angular dependence in that coupling, in that matrix element, then you're going to have anisotropic scattering. So if you go back there, okay, now it's very clear that the number of phonons is independent of beta because the dispersion is flat for optical phonons. The coupling constant is independent of beta. There's no angular dependence there. So optical phonon scattering is isotropic. You can do the same thing for elastic or for acoustic phonon scattering and convince yourself there. Okay.